You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 15 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
It kind of feels like it's been a long time since we recorded. We're so used to doing these one-off special editions that going a full week seems like a long time.
Well, we'll have a one-off special edition later this week. So it won't be too long after this.
Good, we wouldn't want to get rusty.
Later this week, you can look forward to Kevin reviewing the top 10 songs of the year from Pitchfork, which I'm really excited for.
And I am sort of nervous for.
You're nervous for? I really want you to talk about how sexy the song Body Party is. I just can't wait. We don't have to talk anymore about it, but I want to hear you say those words recorded.
There's really no way to avoid it.
Yeah.
All right, on a
completely different note.
Anything we did would be a completely different note after that.
But I want to talk about our lunches today, because we each had interesting lunches, and I'm really excited about it.
You clearly are.
Okay, so where did you go?
I went to Skillet in Capitol Hill, which is the first time I've been to that location.
Skillet Kitchen,
yes.
What'd you think?
I mean, it was really good.
Had you been to Skillet before?
I went to Skillet with you before, and the one in Kiery.
Skillet Counter,
yes.
In the Armory in Seattle Center. Yeah. What'd you get?
I got the chicken scramble.
Oh, how was it? I don't think they don't have that at the Skillet Counter.
It was very good.
The kitchen's more expensive.
I was kind of torn between what to get. You know, I wanted to get poutine they have as an option with your lunch if you have fries. So
it's like an extra $2 though. It's not worth it for the poutine.
Probably not. But
poutine is just big gobs of cheese
and gravy.
Every time I've had poutine, it's like so tempting to try to get, but I feel like I'm gonna die.
there is that.
So I went to Il Corvo today for lunch.
How was that?
Have you been there before?
No.
It is so good. It's like fancy pasta for the business set.
Well, that sounds like something I'd be interested in.
I love corporate lunches, right? And it's in Pioneer Square, and they make up 3 pastas a day, and it's all homemade pasta, and it is so good.
You love corporate lunches?
I really do. I'm telling you, I love specialties. I love sandwiches that corporate people eat. Those people know how to lunch, let me just tell you. But the focaccia at Il Corvo was the best focaccia I've ever had in my entire life. It was so moist and runny and just like melted in your mouth.
You're saying it's better than focaccia that our grandmother used to make.
Well, it really wasn't even close.
Oh, wow.
Really wasn't. It was so good.
You might be thrown out of the family for Christmas.
Well, we'll see what happens. I've talked bad about a ravioli also. It's not what it used to be. It is not what it used to be.
Well, yeah, because we're helping with it.
Oh! But the Il Corvo lunch, so there's 3 choices, and I wanted all 3 of them. I wanted to be like, just put them all in a bowl.
They should do that.
Give me everything. I think that it's too artisan of pasta for them to do that.
Yeah.
For them to mix it all up.
Well, no, you could have like a special bowl that would have 3 compartments specifically designed for these purposes. Purpose built, even.
I still think that artisanal pasta is not meant. But I have to give them an official Fabulous Pelton Cat. Shout out to Il Corvo Pasta.
Wow.
5 stars on the official Fabulous Pelton Cast Yelp review.
Man, my Skillet experience was good, but it wasn't that good.
You gotta go there.
But the clientele at Skillet was very reassuring, because do you know who was sitting at the bar enjoying lunch?
Who is that?
Marshawn Lynch.
What?
Beast mode on his off day from practice, just hanging out.
Do you think Marshawn Lynch lives in the area?
That's a good question, because Capitol Hill is not where I would think of to have a sighting of a Seahawks player.
That is really interesting. He was sitting at the bar. What did he order?
I didn't, like, stalk him.
God, I would have paid attention. I would have done that thing where I was eating and, like, whomever I was with was talking, but I would have only been staring at Marshawn Lynch, especially if he couldn't see me. I would recognize Marshawn Lynch.
Well, the person I was with actually recognized him first, but it was Marshawn Lynch. I mean, you know, he's a pretty recognizable guy.
It's true. He's probably one of the most recognizable Seahawks.
He's got a distinct look. So even though I think he may have been wearing a hoodie, you know, when he turned towards us, you could instantaneously tell that it was beast mode.
And then right now we're drinking. So we're doing our second of 3 weeks of Rogue beer reviews.
Yeah.
And right now we're drinking the Rogue Pumpkin Patch Ale.
which is they grew these pumpkins themselves and then turned it into beer.
Did they?
That's science.
Science. They turn beards into beer and pumpkins into beer.
This one makes me feel less like I'm going to get a hair in it.
Some sort of conjuration that they're doing.
I think this is pretty good.
It is really good. It's still the wrong time period to be drinking it, but I would like something. Earlier today at Mecca, I had a Black Butte Porter. Ooh, did that go down good.
It's the time of year for it.
That is a winter beer.
But you would eat pumpkin pie at this part of the year, wouldn't you?
Absolutely not.
Really, if there was a pumpkin pie served at Christmas, you would turn your nose up at it.
I would take the pie and throw it in the face of the person who offered it to me. I am not joking.
So extreme.
Yeah, it's extreme.
I mean, I had sweet potato pie the other day.
Different than pumpkin pie. I would eat sweet potato pie at almost any time.
All right.
Yeah. So, speaking of beast mode and the Seahawks, last week, coming off of a 23-0 victory against the Giants, it was pretty dominating. It was a dominating defensive performance.
Yeah, I mean, anytime you have a shutout, it's a pretty dominating defensive performance. So I want to talk about that a little bit.
Okay.
Did you see the story about Jet Chevrolet in Auburn?
No. What?
They had a promotion where they were giving away $420,000 to, I believe it was 12 different people, each won $35,000 if the
nice.
Seahawks had a shutout, which they did.
Nice.
So.
Okay.
So they don't actually have to pay this out, fortunately. They took out insurance on it.
It comes from the Seahawks fines.
And they paid $7,000 for the insurance,
uh-huh.
which seems way too low to me.
Okay.
Because it implies that there's a 1 in 60 chance of a shutout.
Yes, that's true. Okay.
So what do you think the odds were of a Seahawks shutout going into that game?
1 in 20.
You are actually too conservative on that.
Really?
So I went and did the math. I went and got the Seahawks adjusted simple rating system for defense and the Giants for offense from profootballreference.com and took this and applied this to the average points per game. And if you do some math on it, you see that the expectation was the Giants should have been scored on average 12.5 points.
Mm-hmm.
You adjust it maybe 1 point for home field advantage, give them 13.5, let's say. And the Seahawks were expected to score by the same method 28 points. So the line of 6.5 was ridiculously low.
It was exactly what we said it should have been, basically.
Yeah, but that matches up with the total for the game, which was 41.5. So it seems to check out. And then if you look at the variance week to week in the scores of those two teams, the implication is that based on the bell curve, you'd have a shutout about 1 in every 17 times the Seahawks
really?
And Giants played.
Really? I stroked my beard the whole time you were talking, as if I was thinking about what you were saying and understanding it, but I have no idea. But, who was the actuary there for that insurance company?
They really screwed that up.
Yeah, clearly it should have been you.
You know, maybe it shouldn't have been. I think it's maybe good that I can take advantage of these situations that no one else understands the math on this.
How were you taking advantage of that? Did you win $35,000 from Bell Chevrolet?
I didn't know about it beforehand. In hindsight, like they had to offer one injury to everyone who wanted one, and then
really?
You got like 100 if you bought a car. So the
yeah.
people who bought a car actually made money probably on the process because there was like 10 of them.
Was it just for this game?
I think just for this game.
That's interesting.
Huh. But I mean, it's pretty reasonable. Like, the Giants are the second worst offense in the league. The Seahawks are the best defense in the league. It's not crazy that there was going to be a shutout.
No, absolutely not. So the game kind of played out, I think, a lot like we were talking. It was the first time that we've broken down a game, and then that actually happened.
What a crazy feeling.
I know, that was really exciting while it was happening. I predicted before the game Eli Manning would throw 4 interceptions. And he threw 5.
Yeah, you undersold it, which I did not see
you
coming.
You scoffed at hit the 4 interceptions.
It's a lot to predict.
You said, pshaw.
I mean, really, I thought that Eli Manning was going to throw some interceptions when they got behind and he started forcing things. And that did happen in the second half.
Yes.
It's just that he had two interceptions in the first half on
three.
Top of that, plus the Hail Mary, which...
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of a fluke, but great decision by Richard Sherman not to bat that down, to come up with the interception. Very positive for his Defensive Player of the Year campaign.
I think that that game especially went a long way for Richard Sherman's Defensive Player of the Year season. And I would say right now it seems to be, and I'm not studying these things in any way, but I think that Richard Sherman is in the lead for Defensive Player of the Year.
I don't know. I mean, The fact is, if you're going to win it, I think you need an eye-catching stat. So I think it's really important for Sherman to lead the league in interceptions, or at least
be near the top. Tied. There's nobody who has the crazy sack totals and also has kind of the star power. Richard Sherman has the star power. He has the notion that he can shut down receivers and also the interceptions.
And the other thing is the elite defenses don't necessarily feature that star pass rusher. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, it's Arizona's number two. Carolina, I think, is number three in the league.
And there's nobody probably from either of those defenses. Patrick Peterson is somebody you could potentially consider, but I don't think it's really in the conversation.
I think the biggest threat to Sherman winning it, honestly, is Earl Thomas splitting the votes.
Yes, I agree. But so the other thing is when we were looking at the Giants, we were breaking down about how the Giants are a better defensive team than a lot of people realize. That a lot of their flaws is Eli Manning. And that they played a really solid defensive game. It's just they couldn't make up for all of the mistakes that Eli Manning was making.
Yeah, and that's pretty much exactly how it played out. I think there was a lot of frustration among Seahawks fans. The team wasn't moving the ball more easily, scoring more points. I mean, part of that was simply struggling on third down, which over a single game or even a single half, which really is what we're talking about on Sunday, it's just noise. What happens on third down, it's completely random, almost. So that was part of it. But, you know, the Giants did a good job defensively. You felt bad for their defense to just get hung out to dry by Eli Manning time and time again.
It's true. And also, I mean, you have to get a lot of uncredit to the Giants' offensive line. And when you think about the Giants, what do you think about, right? When you think about who they're investing in?
Eli and defensive ends.
Eli and defensive ends. And to have a great quarterback, you have to have, especially a quarterback like Eli Manning, who's not getting the ball out of there like that.
He's definitely not scrambling.
And he's not scrambling. He's not making plays. You have to invest at some point in an offensive line. And I think the Giants completely didn't realize that that was a thing that they had to do. And they were just investing in defensive ends and Eli Manning.
Yeah, and I mean, the unit has deteriorated. Time has really taken a toll on it. The departure of Chris Snee hasn't helped. And yeah, the Seahawks were able to get pressure up the middle with something they talked about being important against Manning. And the couple of times they had Bobby Wagner come up the middle and on linebacker blitzes very successfully.
It was really exciting to see Bobby get off there like that, and Michael Bennett having a hell of a game.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a great performance by the defensive line. Also, it's just shutting down the Giants' run game entirely.
Yeah, the Giants got nothing on the ground. But let's move our attention to the Cardinals next week.
Yeah, I think this is an interesting matchup where the Cardinals are a team that is on the rise in the NFC, you know, playing better football over the second half of the season since we last saw them in Week 7 and won down in Arizona at University of Phoenix Stadium. Now at 9-5, their chances of making the playoffs are remote, but, you know, if they were in the AFC, they'd be in the driver's seat for a wild card spot.
Yeah, it's pretty unfortunate for the Cardinals. I mean, they've had a great season. They're one of probably the 10 best teams in the league, and they're most likely, I mean, the scenarios really don't play out for them to make the playoffs. And I think that's really unfortunate for them because I like to see good teams be rewarded. But thinking back to that victory in Arizona on a Thursday night, we thought it was a good win at the time. But now I think it probably was the best road win that the Seahawks have had all season. I think it's a better road win than the Carolina road win.
No, I don't agree with that. I mean, I know the Carolina is a much more different team now than they were in Week 1 as compared to Arizona now from Week 7. But still,
I don't think Arizona is a particularly different team from what they were in Week 7.
I think Carson Palmer is playing a lot better now than he was then.
And so we had the debate then, which was, so we've looked at this.
Is Carson Palmer a viable NFL quarterback?
It is. That really was the debate. And I've always believed in Carson Palmer maybe a little bit more than I should have. But you were saying that Carson Palmer isn't even an NFL caliber quarterback. And it's really played out that Carson Palmer is a viable NFL quarterback. And then the Cardinals, and this is kind of what we said for a long time, I think they're kind of similar to the Seahawks 2 seasons ago when Tarvarius Jackson was the quarterback, that with that defense that they have, putting a quarterback who's capable under center means that they're going to be a good team.
Yeah, I mean, I think all you need is competence, averageness, which, you know, I think it's an underrated skill in NFL quarterbacks. Like, people constantly bagged on Tarvarius Jackson, but then, you know, when Charlie Weyerhurst was in there that season, you found out, hey, average is actually not that bad.
Do you think the Cardinals' record would be better, worse, or the same if Tarvarius Jackson was their quarterback?
Probably about the same.
I think they would maybe be one win worse.
I think that they would have played better in the early part of the season because Carson Palmer was, again, really, really bad through the first 6 weeks. He completely undermined their chances to win. And now he's just giddy out of the way and managing the game, proverbially. And the Cardinals' defense is still so good that now they're just dominating. And that's what surprised me. I thought that they were going to see some drop-off after losing Ray Horton.
Yeah, I was thinking that actually a lot of credit had to be given to Ray Horton and weirdly to Ken Whisenhunt. So they left that Cardinals team. Ken Whisenhunt was fired almost entirely because he never could find, after Kurt Warner retired, the quarterback. And I think that both of them...
Wait. It's one thing to not be able to find the quarterback. It's another thing to cycle through a bunch of undrafted rookies and... Like, they had four different guys play quarterback for them last year.
It's the hardest
thing. Also, they lost 58-0 in Seattle.
I can't believe those. It was basically a year ago this week, right? Was it week 15?
I think it was a year ago last week, yeah.
That happened. And now we're talking about a team who's 9-5 and unfortunately probably won't make the playoffs, but is a playoff-caliber team. That's a team that we beat 58-0.
You can't overestimate the importance of a quarterback.
The difference is staggering.
It's insane.
I guess the Cardinals got a lot of points. I was thinking that they had to put up a lot of points last week, but a lot of it came from Antoine Kaysen getting an interception return. It wasn't necessarily Carson Palmer putting the team on his back, but he had a nice game last week. But I do think that with Whisenhunt and Horton, and also their GM, he's really young. What is his name? So they have a young GM. I think that they've drafted really well, and the Cardinals, really, I would say that they've built very similarly to the way that the Seahawks have built.
Steve Keim is the Cardinals GM.
And picking up somebody like Andre Ellington a little bit deeper in the draft, Carson Palmer coming basically out of nowhere, being cast off by the Raiders, picking up Patrick Peterson, he was a top pick, picking up Tyrann Mathieu. A lot of their team has been pulled together from these kind of weird places, and it's been built defensively, and now they're building up their offense. Arizona is one of the scariest teams to think about for next season.
I know, I mean, it's a little weird to talk about next season because they're probably going to have to trade Larry Fitzgerald, and he's so much of their offensive identity.
I don't think it'll matter if they trade Larry Fitzgerald.
I think you're underestimating the impact of that.
I think that they're built from the defense first, and they're going to have a lot of their same defensive players around, and they'll have another year of Patrick Peterson. I mean, next year is irrelevant, but talking about this game, what do you think about the Cardinals?
Well, I think, you know, there's one of the interesting differences between the Cardinals and the Seahawks of a couple years ago, if you're making that comparison. They're not very good on special teams. They're number 24 in the league in Football Outsiders special teams DVOA. So that's one big area where the Seahawks, I think, could have an edge.
It's true. And I mean, we talk about the Seahawks record or potentially breaking the record for fewest punt return yards against them. But they've been solid on special teams in every capacity. And I think that Pete really enforces that. And I think that other teams, I really believe that special teams are a lot about coaching and effort and about how much you're invested in them. And I think that the Cardinals, once they get everything else in place, can fill out their special teams. Right now, they're not there yet because they had to focus on getting their offense going. They couldn't focus on the special teams at that point. But I think that they will in the future, but it could be a big difference for the Seahawks this week.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think a couple of things, if we look at the Cardinals on offense... Larry Fitzgerald is expected to play. Okay. That's what Bruce Arians said today, despite suffering a concussion and covering an onside kick late in that win in Tennessee.
Pretty ugly, too.
Yeah.
That was an uncomfortable play to watch. You were in the other room when that was on. And Larry Fitzgerald had the ball in his hands and was blown up.
I think I just saw the aftermath when he was sitting on the sidelines. And it was evident that he had a concussion.
He's one of those players that you don't like. I mean, you don't like to see anybody injured, but especially Larry Fitzgerald.
No, and especially in that manner,
yeah.
You know, because you give up these late touchdowns and you have to try to cover an onside kick, it was just ugly all together there. And that's the one thing. I mean, Arizona is not coming off a particularly impressive performance. I mean, they were on the road at Tennessee, but, you know, had a 2-touchdown lead and gave it up.
No, and I think the place that they really regressed was defensively. So they're the second best defensive team in the NFL, but... their defense didn't look particularly great. I mean, they're playing against the Titans at home. Ryan Fitzpatrick is not a bad quarterback, but he's also not the kind of quarterback who should be throwing for over 400 yards against you.
I mean, that's just some Fitz magic.
That's classic Fitz magic. It's one place where I think that the Seahawks, Kendall Wright, 12 receptions for 150 yards, 20 targets for Kendall Wright last week.
And that's really out of the ordinary because the Cardinals have been excellent all season long against all kinds of wide receivers. They, I believe, are number two against number one wide receivers in Football Outsiders DVOA and in the top 10 as well against number two wide receivers and then slot types.
So that'll be a big thing to pay attention to this week, which is the Seahawks wide receivers versus the Cardinals secondary. I think some of the wear of their secondary might be showing at this point in the season. They've got Peterson left over, but they've got a couple of young safeties, and they're now without Tron Bethew. And this was their first game without the Honey Badger, and it clearly showed that the Titans were able to move the ball against them through the air.
Yeah, and then it got even worse because Rashad Johnson, one of their other starting safeties, suffered a high ankle sprain in that game, so he's not expected to play on Sunday. And if that's the case, they'll be putting undrafted rookie Tony Jefferson in there at free safety.
So that'll be an interesting place. I think if I had to predict, I would say that I think the Cardinals will stay in the game. I think Russell will go over 300 yards passing, and that it'll be a game where we're more contingent on the pass than the run for the Seahawks. Another game, really.
And I think then protecting Russell becomes a big factor. You know, obviously that's been better lately, but the Giants were able to get some pressure on Sunday, and John Abraham had two sacks down in Arizona.
I agree. The offensive line is different now than it was then. The offensive line is much better, and they've got everybody back than the last time that they played Arizona. But that'll be the most important thing at this point. And ideally, the Seahawks win the game and then can sit everybody for week 17.
Obviously. And then I think another wild card is tight ends. Arizona's been bad at covering tight ends all season. They give up the most completions to them, most yardage to them. In week 7, Zach Miller had 5 catches for 40 yards, and Luke Wilson added a catch for 23 yards. So I think that's a place where the Seahawks can make up some hay.
And that's interesting also. I mean, they bring a lot of pressure, so they're going to leave tight ends uncovered. And they also have those young safeties who aren't necessarily accustomed to picking them up at this point in their career.
Yeah, they could even be weaker there. On the other side of the field, I think Andre Ellington is the wild card. Apparently they're using him more out wide as a wide receiver, and he had 4 catches for 87 yards on Sunday.
I mean, Andre Ellington is great, but it's just been something that the Seahawks have covered really well this season. They have not let running backs catch the ball against them.
I mean, covered everything well lately.
Yeah, it's true. But in particular, defending against running backs, the Seahawks have been very good, and they're going to know when Andre Ellington is in the game, and they're going to know that he's somebody who they need to be watching as far as the pass goes.
The other thing we saw in Week 7 was the Seahawks had 7 sacks in that game. Bennett and Averill really pinned their ears back and got after the quarterback, especially after the Cardinals fell behind and sort of had to abandon the run. So we'll see if something similar happens, and this time they'll even have the extra advantage of having, you know, the CenturyLink Field crowd behind them.
It's true, but I don't expect that to happen this week. I wouldn't predict more than 2 or 3 sacks.
That's so unconfident from you. I would have expected you to predict like 10.
Like, I'm making crazy predictions every week. I made a reasonable prediction.
I mean, it didn't pan out.
He threw more interceptions. Eli Manning threw more interceptions than I predicted.
I'm just saying, and I want to get to this before we say our percentages of winning.
Okay.
One of our faithful listeners, Damon, emailed this week to first note that you were dead on your prediction of
Thank
the
you,
4
Damon.
Interceptions.
Thank you very much.
And he said that your new nickname should be Mr. 100 because you're so confident about things.
Mr. 100. I don't know.
Mr. 100%.
I understand.
Yeah.
The fantasy genius, Mr. 100. I'm sure that Damon was very informed about the game after listening to our podcast. And the one time that it played out the way that we discussed, this week they'll probably run the ball like crazy. They'll get 10 sacks.
You know, I'm optimistic there will be a second time at some point this season.
And you know what? I was very confident about that. I really need to harp on this because it's the one time that it's happened all season long. But we had a mini debate about whether the Giants were one of the two or three worst teams in the NFL. And that team looked like the worst team in the NFL.
I don't know. I mean, there's no shortage of competitors.
They looked significant. Okay. Texans, who are, I believe they clinched the number one seed. The number one pick. And obviously a much closer game against the Texans, right? The Jaguars, who are generally considered one of the worst teams, they played a pretty close game in Seattle.
Pretty close game.
All right, not a pretty close game.
They mailed it in the fourth quarter.
The Seahawks didn't shut out the Jaguars.
It's true. They did not shut out the Jaguars.
This was the most dominating performance that the Seahawks have had this side of the Saints and the 49ers.
I think that's fair.
It was the most dominating road performance
of
the season.
And it did improve the DVOA. Seahawks now third all-time in DVOA through week 15.
That's pretty cool.
So, you know.
When we talk about, and I mean, this has been a conversation around Seattle that we can really feel that something special is going on here, and that kind of really helps you see how special this is, what the difference between this 2013 season is as compared to 2005.
Well, I mean, last year they were seventh, so, you know, it's a style of play that obviously is very conducive to success the last couple of years.
Also, thank you very much, Pete Carroll.
Yeah.
Thank you for being the coach of the Seahawks.
Pete Carroll has already delivered everyone in Seattle his Christmas gift well ahead of time.
Chances of winning?
85%.
Wow, that is so far off from where I'm going to predict.
What are you going to predict?
55%.
55?
This is the home game that I am most nervous about in the last two seasons. Just something about this game is really scaring me. The Cardinals are a really good team. I think that this game means more to the Cardinals than it does to the Seahawks. Their defense is on fire. I'm nervous going into it. I said before the Saints game that I think that the home win streak is going to end this season, and I don't think it's going to end next week. I think that the Seahawks have a very good chance of losing this game.
I think those are all fair points, but the Seahawks are still a dramatically better team.
You're Mr. They're, 85%.
They're 10.5-point favorites.
I think that the spread is too high. It should be 4.5.
4.5.
Maybe 6.5. The spread should be 6.5.
They needed overtime last week to beat Tennessee.
A good Tennessee team. An underrated Tennessee team.
A Tennessee team that lost at home to Jacksonville four weeks earlier.
They did get kind of lucky to beat Tennessee last week. I mean, they did get a defensive touchdown in the fourth quarter.
I mean, I think they're going to be more up for this game. It'll be a different game.
But I'm more scared of the Cardinals than I have been of the 49ers, of the Saints. This team right now scares me at this point in the season.
Well, hopefully the Seahawks are sufficiently scared as well and motivated to come out with a strong performance.
So you want to talk about basketball really quick?
Yeah, I think we should talk about that. It's a sport.
We're recording this on a Tuesday night, and earlier tonight, Damian Lillard with another game-winning shot.
His second game winner in as many games for the Blazers on the road. It was slightly unsatisfying because the referees put 0.4 seconds back on the clock. It wasn't like a complete walk-off shot, which would have been ideal, but it was still a pretty impressive. About a 28-foot three-pointer to win against the Cavaliers.
Were they down? I didn't get to see
any
of this. They were tied.
Yeah.
I got a league pass alert, and I was like, oh, man, I want to watch that. But I think I was driving at the time.
And Lillard outdueled Kyrie Irving. A good matchup of elite young point guards had finished with 36 points, 10 assists, 8 rebounds.
That is amazing. So this is going to be the first NBA game. We're going to Portland this weekend to see the Blazers and the Pelicans. I'm sad that we're not going to get to see Anthony Davis, but this will be the first NBA game that I'll have been to for two seasons. And I'm really excited that I'm going to get to see the second best team in the NBA.
Who are you putting ahead of them?
Indiana.
Really?
Indiana number one, Portland number two. I am all in on this Blazers team.
They're very exciting to watch.
I don't believe that this Blazers team is going to regress either.
I mean, I think they're going to regress a little bit because they're not going to keep winning shots on buzzer beaters all the time.
Winning in Detroit is a huge win, too.
Yeah, the Pistons followed that up the next night by winning at Indiana.
Yeah, that was a huge win for them.
Yeah.
So I am all in on the Blazers. And being able to watch a really good team play basketball, it'll be the first time that I've been able to do that since 2003, maybe?
2004-05.
2004-05 Sonics. Sorry.
Which is the team that this Blazers team reminds me a lot of. You want a stat, though?
I do.
Three times this year, the Seahawks and the Blazers, Paul Allen's two teams, have played on the same day, and they are 6-0 combined.
Really? Do they play on Sunday?
They do not.
The Blazers just don't play. I guess they're playing on Saturday night. So that'd be kind of cool, yeah, going to the Blazers game on Saturday night and then coming back to see the Seahawks.
You'll have the same Paul Allen experience.
Are you experienced?
You're going to be taking a helicopter. We're going to be taking a helicopter there and back, correct?
Yeah.
And then staying in our palatial suite that's inside the Rose Garden.
Oh, I'm going to be staying in a yacht.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. That's pretty exciting. And then the Huskies, earlier today, playing against Tulane.
And they won. That's the important thing. They won.
I didn't even know that game was happening.
Tulane rated number 300 in the nation by Ken Pomeroy, but a rare non-conference road win for the Huskies.
That's solid 300.
You do not get a lot of that.
They look no worse than 275.
You can tell me that. You could convince me they're 274. Right? You talk
to him. I'm sad. So next week I have to come back to the Blazers. I don't even know what we're talking about, this other team. But I'm sad that we're doing previews next week of the NBA on Christmas Day games, and I really wish that the Blazers were playing on Christmas Day, or the Pacers. Two of the best teams in the league aren't playing on Christmas Day.
Yeah, that's a tough one. And teams that people really are excited about seeing right now, I think.
I would love to see Blazers Warriors on Christmas Day.
That was a couple years ago we had that matchup.
It would be thrilling. The Warriors are playing.
They're playing the Clippers, I believe.
That's a good game, too.
Yeah.
They should. I mean, I just don't want to see any of the East
teams. Warriors should actually be rotating around playing several West teams on Christmas Day, because they play very entertaining games.
That's true. I also am curious to see Phoenix, you know? And they're not playing either. There are a lot of teams in the West that I would like to see that we're not going to get to see, because we're going to be watching the Knicks and the Nets play.
Well,
many of the worst teams in the league.
But the Huskies, the competition gets significantly tougher on Sunday when UConn comes to town.
That'll be fun.
Yes. Yes, it will. And great, an official Fabulous Pelinkas shout down to the scheduling at UW Athletics. We've talked about this before, I think.
I've already given them an official Fabulous Pelinkas shout
down. I'm going to rejoin that.
Yeah.
I'm going to make it both of us, because putting that up against a Seahawks game is just, it's no good for anyone.
I agree.
I don't know what kind of crowd there's going to be, but it's not going
to
be the same.
Are
kind
you going
of crowd.
To that game?
I am going to go, because, you know, there's four NBA prospects in that game. And I, even though I saw UConn twice already in New York, I have to go watch
that. That's a huge mistake. Are you available to pick me up after the Seahawks game? What time is the Husky game?
12:30. This is very compelling. Okay. Podcast.
We're doing our planning. But let's turn to the main event. The main event of the podcast, which is ranking our top five Christmas songs.
We really should have advertised this earlier in the podcast. It was going to be the main event. People may have already tuned out.
Well, I doubt they have. We'll record an intro. Just stay tuned for the main event. Tristan and Al talk about their favorite Christmas songs.
Everybody is exactly what you've been waiting to hear, I'm assuming.
I've been waiting to talk about my top five favorite Christmas songs for so long. I've been listening to Warm 106.9, which is playing nonstop Christmas music, and thinking all sorts of things about every song. I've got like 9 different songs that I want to talk about. Top five really is not enough for me. I've got at least 2 honorable mentions. I've got my least favorite Christmas song and a top five honorable mention.
Wow, this is... get settled in.
You're going to hear a lot about Christmas songs. All right, do you want to start with your number 5?
All right, my number 5 is Christmas in the Room by Sufjan Stevens.
Oh, wow.
So...
Holy cow.
That's quite a reaction. The Sufjan Stevens Christmas canon is indispensable for me during the month between Thanksgiving and Christmas, which is the only appropriate time to play Christmas music. Oh, all the way up to Epiphany, actually.
Oh, I disagree.
It's okay after.
I don't Christmas. Know what Epiphany is, but...
You wouldn't.
Christmas Day is the last day that Christmas music sounds good until the very next year. On the day after Thanksgiving, you go 11 months and Christmas music sounds like the most horrible thing in the world, because Christmas is great, right? Once Christmas is over, it is 364 more days until Christmas.
Yes, but not until the Christmas season.
It's true. There's only about 330 days until the Christmas season.
Shopping days.
Shopping days. There was a Simpsons episode where they were talking about how great the feeling is on Sunday morning when you leave church, because it's the moment that's farthest away from when you have to go to church the next week. And I remember seeing that, and this was when we were kids and we went to church, and I thought to myself, how brilliant are they that they realize that that is such a great moment when you leave there, but it's such a horrible moment the minute Christmas is over, because it's the farthest moment away from the greatest holiday in the world.
It's true. But you are only 6 months away from Christmas in July.
That's true. I can't believe that you have... So did you... We'll talk about Sufjan Stevens in a minute. We'll come back to Sufjan Stevens.
Circle back?
Yeah. Okay. Because he deserves a big chunk in the conversation.
That's fair.
Okay, my number five is Christmas and Hollis by Run DMC. I was hoping that we would have completely different lists, but now I'm concerned that we're not going to.
Well, you should remain concerned about that based on your number five.
I know. I'm shocked that you got Christmas in the room. Christmas and Hollis. It's such a weird song, right? So there's the opening verse where Reverend Run...
Dude, by weird you mean amazing.
Well, all Christmas music is really weird, right?
Valid.
So there's the opening verse where he goes into the park and sees an old man and his dog. But then his dog turns out to be an ill reindeer.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then there's a complicated story where the old, who turns out to be Santa Claus, the old man, loses his wallet, Rev Run finds it, and then Santa Claus comes back and tells him it's filled with a million in cash called hundreds of G's, and Santa Claus comes back later in the day to let him know that it was intentional that he left his wallet. It's a very complicated story, and a very complicated way for Santa Claus to deliver this gift to Rev Run.
It does seem inefficient, but then it's no more inefficient than going to every house in the world and delivering presents in one night.
That's true. Also, I feel like he didn't really get the point of the song. DMC gets it. He's talking about actual moments like mom is cooking chicken and collard greens and they're singing Christmas carols, things that actually happen on Christmas at Hollis. Rev Run is talking about this crazy scenario involving an ill reindeer.
But I think that's it, is that he's localizing Christmas to what he's seeing on a day-to-day in Hollis.
I suppose so. He's seeing old men with dogs who turn out to be ill reindeers who are losing their wallets that end up with having millions in cash. Also, having millions in cash inside of a wallet would be just... The logic doesn't make any sense, but it's a great song. It is the best hip-hop Christmas song there is.
Oh, without question.
It tops Santa Baby from the mid-90s. It tops a Dipset Christmas somehow.
Although a Dipset Christmas was our finest Christmas.
Yes, it's true.
I agree with that. I don't like Santa Baby as a song in general. So even when Mason the Locks did it, I still don't like it that much.
Santa Baby by Eartha Kitt, I believe. Is that right?
I don't know. I can look that up.
It really demonstrates how sexy Christmas can be.
Just trying to get sexy back in here.
Oh yeah, I'm bringing sexy back. That was a timely reference. Listening to that song is so weird though. That came out on Warm 106.9 and I was like, what a weird song. This person is trying to seduce Santa Claus for a thing called a sable, which I don't even know what that is.
Yes,
I've got a lot of thoughts on Christmas songs. Anyway, I'm going to do your number four.
You sure you don't want to go
on? Was Eartha Kitt Catwoman?
I don't know.
I think she was. Anyway. That's Julie Andrews. Sorry.
Gone so far off here. All right, number four for me is Christmas Wrapping by The Waitresses.
We have the exact same list. That's crazy.
I mean, how could we not have the same list? We listened to the exact same Christmas
music at the same time. I went out of my way to have different Christmas songs.
What did you think was going to be on that list?
I don't know. I thought you would have Last Christmas by Wham.
I mean, I considered that.
I don't know.
That might be an honorable mention for me. You thought I was going to have... Simply Having a Wonderful Christmas Time, didn't you?
Oh, Paul McCartney.
Yeah.
Happy Xmas, War is Over. I thought some of those might be in there. No, I didn't actually think so. I knew that you would have Christmas Wrapping.
That's always been one of my favorites.
I knew that was one of your favorites.
I especially like any proto-rap involving white people.
Any other thoughts on Christmas Wrapping? Because I have many.
Let's just let you turn your lips.
So, you know, at the end of the year, you make year-in-review lists, right?
Yes.
This song is a Christmas song year in review.
It's kind of like a Christmas letter to everyone she knows.
It is.
Yeah.
She goes through the whole year, and we're hearing about her life the whole time. And then at the end of the year, that's the most important part, but really, it just everything culminated. Everything that she was working to throughout the year culminated in this great Christmas moment.
It's a wonderful piece of narrative.
It's not just a Christmas song, though. It's a Thanksgiving song. It's a summer song. It's a song for all occasions.
Do you listen to it on those occasions?
No. No chance. No way. Christmas Day is over. I'd never listen to that song until the next Thanksgiving.
Of course not.
I also think it was really weird, and we talked about this, how Christmas Wrapping is just on a waitress's album. Like, if you got an album, which I don't know, that's a crazy scenario these days, but let's say that you're listening to an album and there's one Christmas song right in the middle of it, that would sound really weird, right?
I guess that will sound weird on my number two song.
Oh! Well, I'm excited for your number two song. Okay, my number four was Holiday Road by Lindsey Buckingham. You don't have that one, do you?
I do not have that.
All right.
Wait, I didn't even think of that as a Christmas song.
You don't think of that as a Christmas song?
No, I think of that as a song from Vacation.
It's in National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. And that's why it's on here, solely for its inclusion in the greatest Christmas movie of all time.
Wait, agree first. But are we sure it's not in the original Vacation as well?
I am 100% sure.
Okay.
I mean, it might be in there, but that would be weird. That's not a holiday movie. They're just traveling. That's a road trip movie.
Yeah, it's road.
No. Holiday Road.
I mean, when you take a vacation, it's a holiday.
In
Lindsey Buckingham's world.
Oh, Lindsey Buckingham's crazy world. It's National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. You agree? Greatest Christmas movie of all time?
Unquestionable.
For me, and I know that I'm going to sound like a mom when I say this, number two, Elf, starring Will Ferrell. I think that movie is hilarious.
No, that movie is really good and heartwarming.
It is the one Christmas movie I can watch it in June, Christmas in July, and still think it's hilarious.
But you were saying that you watched Christmas Vacation with your son?
Yes! 19-month-old baby Luca. I said that weird. Really enjoyed Christmas Vacation. He thought it was hilarious. So that's kind of the humor level that both of us apparently are at, thinking it's the best movie. There are all sorts of scenes involving outlandish scenarios, involving squirrels running around the house and a dog chasing after him. Also, Elaine.
Yeah.
There's a scene where Chevy Chase, Clark Griswold, is trying to get his lights to work, and they don't work, and then he has a display of reindeer and Santa Claus in his front yard, the plastic kind that Grandma and Grandpa have.
This is good for anyone who has not seen the movie Christmas Vacation. Oh, both of you, you're really missing out.
And in that scene, you might have a baby at home listening. I would recommend this to them. It's hilarious. In that scene where Clark Griswold is destroying the reindeer, Luca thought it was hilarious. He thought it was one of the funniest things he'd ever seen. And I was like, I knew it. High five. Boom.
I think it's important to get your children watching Christmas Vacation young. I'm sure we did at a very young age.
Here's a weird thing about that movie. There are boobs in the movie. Plus a lot of swearing.
There are boobs in the movie?
Yeah.
I don't know if I've ever seen the a normal version. I think I've only watched the TV version.
They used to show it on NBC pretty often on the Sunday after Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
And the vacation movies in general have a lot of boobs. European Vacation too. So those are things. If you have a young...
I mean, that's what European is usually synonymous for, right?
Yeah. So that was a little bit strange, but there's a lot of swearing in that movie. You would be surprised.
All right.
Cautionary tale. Anyway, what's your number? We're only number three.
Yeah, you have a lot of thought. My number three is Christmas in Oz.
Okay, good, good. I've already expressed my myriad of thoughts about that one.
It's an awesome song.
My number three, Christmas Wrapping by the Waitresses.
Well, there you go. All right, my number two, and I was noting, contemporary album right in the middle of it, I Wish It Was Christmas Today by Julian Casablancas.
Oh, interesting. I do not have that one. But I Wish It Was Christmas Today.
See, you know, I totally disagree with the premise of I Wish It Was Christmas Today, because Christmas is actually the worst.
I agree.
Because it's the most time until there's Christmas is actually Christmas Day.
I agree.
It's a constant disappointment. It's never as good as you were hoping it's going to be. And Christmas Eve and the anticipation of Christmas is the real winner.
100%. That's why you'll notice that... I'm surprised that you're giving Julian Casablancas credit for that.
Well, his version of it is the best, with all due respect to Jimmy
Better
Fallon.
Better than the original
and Horatio
version.
Sands and the crew.
So that was on Saturday Night Live in 2002. And I remember, because I have thoughts about every single Christmas song, I remember we would always gather at our grandparents' house right next door to us here, and our cousins would often come over. The whole family would get together. And you and I went home from Grandma and Grandpa's house late one night, before the very end of Saturday Night Live, when that was on. And then we went back there the next morning, on Sunday morning, and we're talking to our cousins, Katie and Chris, and they were like, the most amazing thing happened on Saturday Night Live last night. There was a person, Jimmy Fallon was playing this song, and Tracy Morgan was dancing crazily on the side. And it was, I Wish It Was Christmas Today. And then I saw it. This was in an era before YouTube, so yeah. I had to wait a long time before we could see it.
Yeah, very different.
And it was probably May by the time I saw it. But it was amazing.
And now it's number 2 on my list.
Very weird when it came back with Julian Casablancas. That was unexpected and a great addition.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a nice move. Nice move, Julian Casablancas.
Well done.
My number 2, Christmas in the Maroon by Sufjan Stevens.
Well, there you go.
How did we choose out of the 120 Sufjan Stevens songs the same song?
I mean, we have very similar interests in general, so I guess it makes sense.
I switched it up last minute, right before we started recording. Initially, I saw Three Ships by Sufjan Stevens.
Interesting.
That's my number 1 traditional Christmas song.
My number 1 traditional Christmas song, I just love O Come Emmanuel, so Sufjan Stevens performing that would probably be my number 1 traditional song.
Has he never? He has.
Yeah, it's on there. Yeah. There's like multiple different versions of O Come Emmanuel. I think there's like an acoustic.
So there are a lot of O Come Emmanuels. Christmas in the Room is a great song because it encapsulates.
So it tries the charm.
The emptiness and the loneliness of Christmas in the Christmas season.
See, but I feel like it's ultimately a positive song because it's like, I don't need Christmas to be what everyone else wants Christmas to be for me to have a good Christmas.
Yes, I agree. But it's understanding there's a sparseness to Christmas that can exist, and that if you're alone during the Christmas season, it could be the best of times, or it could be the worst of times. To quote somebody who I think wrote a Christmas story, that was terrible.
Thanks, Dickens.
But Sufjan Stevens has this whole Christmas canon, and about half of them are just joyful Christmas songs. And about the other half of them are ruminations on the season. Because when you think about it, right now it's December 18th, and I'm feeling holly and jolly and Christmas. And there are people out there who are scared of Christmas coming. There are people out there who are sad that the days are short, who are not living around all of their family within a short radius. And I think that's a really important thing to think about this time of year.
I mean, I think Sufjan's Christmas work strikes a nice balance. I think you put it well, that it's the combination of... It's more than just two. It's also, you know, it's traditional, it's very religious Christmas music.
Yes.
And also Christmas music that's not religious whatsoever.
Both of those also.
Yeah.
Happy, sad, religious, not religious.
So it captures anything you could want from Christmas music is somewhere in Sufjan Stevens' Christmas albums.
It's true, and it's surprising that we both... So there's the two different Christmas compilations by Sufjan Stevens. There's the silver and gold compilation, that's the new one, and then there's the original one, which is called... I can't remember. The original 5 albums that came out. And then there's the new one, and I'm surprised, because the new Christmas compilation, which is like 2011 through 2006 or so, and a lot of it is electronic Christmas songs, and it's really weird, right? He covers Alphabet Street by Prince. it's a weird mixture of songs.
I mean, I'm still listening to the Sufjan Stevens Christmas CD that you made me of the best of those songs.
That was the best of the first 5 albums.
So I haven't even listened to almost any of the new stuff.
It's weird. But it's weird that we both chose a song from the new songs.
Huh.
And a Sufjan Stevens original. But it's an interesting... That's a great song.
I believe we're on our number ones.
Okay, what's your number 1?
Now, I've declared this not only the best Christmas song, but also the best song full stop in the past. And that song is Santa Claus is Coming to Town is performed by Bruce Springsteen.
Oh, the best song ever! You think Santa Claus is Coming to Town, but I stood up. By Bruce Springsteen is better than any song from the Bruce Springsteen catalog.
I think I may have gotten carried away in the Christmas spirit last year.
Are you kidding me? Promised Land?
But we went to go see Bruce
Thunder
Springsteen.
Thunder Road?
We went to go see Bruce Springsteen a year ago in Portland. And was it not the highlight of the show?
We were in the Christmas spirit. But no, it wasn't the highlight of the show.
Oh, it was the highlight of the show. What I love about this song is the way that Bruce Springsteen sounds legitimately confused. Like, what time is it? Christmas time. He really sells it.
Bruce Springsteen sells everything.
I mean, everybody's got, you know, stocky or, you know, got Santa hats on and everything. I mean, it's an amazing experience live.
I'm trying to think of what the highlight of that show was. But Santa Claus is Coming to Town was good.
It was amazing.
Amazing.
I mean, you may not remember because you may have been too busy dealing with throwing up earlier in the evening.
Oh, that didn't happen. All right. Wow. I'm still shocked that you got that potentially the best song of all time.
I don't know if anyone... obviously Bruce Springsteen is known for the emotion of his songs, but I don't know if there's any emotion he feels as strongly as his...
Santa Claus is coming to town.
Yes. He owns that song.
All of his feelings about the working man. Santa Claus is coming to town. I can't believe you just said that. Okay, all right. I regained myself here. After you said that Santa Claus is Coming to Town is the greatest song of all time, it's only listenable to 1 month out of the year. The Ignition remix.
It's a good song.
Oh my god. Okay. My number one Christmas song, Christmas is Coming by the Vince Guaraldi Trio from Charlie Brown Christmas.
Wow.
Now,
number one.
No, it's not even close, really. Honestly, I would rather listen to the Charlie Brown Christmas album more than any of the other top five songs. Vince Guaraldi's...
Even more than Sufjan Stevens.
Probably. I mean, it's only one album. It's not the kind of scope that has. And it's all instrumental also. I guess there's a few like kids singing in it. But that's what Christmas sounds like. Vince Guaraldi singing or playing Santa or Christmas is Coming. That whole album is what Christmas sounds like. So I have this joke that I like to play, or I like to say to Mrs. Fantasy Genius. And it came out, I don't know, 1957, 1958 in that range. And I like to think of Vince Guaraldi as like a classic jazz player. So he's playing this and it's all piano at the beginning and then the drums come in and I'm like, oh my god, how high was that drummer right now? I'm like, you know that Vince Guaraldi just shot heroin before he started recording this.
That's definitely, look at his mustache. That looks like a guy who...
Yeah. I really like to imagine him as like a classic jazz player, like Miles Davis. And then I was saying to her this weekend, I was like, oh yeah, Charles Schulz, I heard that in 1953, he got really high and then wrote out a full year of Peanuts cartoons on one really long sheet. I think this is a hilarious joke. The idea of imagining Vince Guaraldi as a classic jazz player and Charles Schulz as Jack Kerouac writing his Peanuts cartoons. I don't know why.
This is why you're on the same level in terms of comedy as your 19-month-year-old child.
Oh, man. Okay, so we've talked about Christmas music for a really long time. I might have to get rid of my... I'll say, okay... Least favorite Christmas song, Baby It's Cold Outside by Dean Martin.
Why? Yeah, okay, let's go into that.
Okay.
I know, but I want you to say it.
First off, it's not even a Christmas song. It's a temperature song.
That's true.
It could be played at any time of the year when it's cold outside. It could be like, oh, baby, it's unseasonably cold in April. Right? It's not a Christmas song. Perfect Dean Martin impression also.
No.
No. Also, I mean, it's hard for me to get past the rapey elements of it, right?
It's true.
He's not really offering lodging because it's warm where he is. He's trying to nail this broad.
I mean, as much discussion as there was about the content of Blurred Lines...
I was going to say, Dean Martin is the modern Robin Thicke. Wait. Robin Thicke is the modern Dean Martin. It makes me really uncomfortable listening to it. Also, it's a really obnoxious song. And the woman who sings in the song, who sings about half of the song, not credited at all, just Dean Martin.
It was a different time.
Yeah, it's credited to Dean Martin and some broad, actually. His request.
He doesn't even bother learning her name.
Yeah. That's a dame. So anyway, that's my least favorite Christmas song of the year. I hate that song. Oh my god. Any other thoughts on... Are you going to say that Santa Claus is Coming to Town is the best song ever again?
I stand by my opinion. I don't know if I have a least favorite Christmas song.
Well, that's too bad.
There's not one that really stands out. But I really can't stand Santa Baby. That might be it.
Too sexy for you.
I mean, it's just like the... like seeing like a child, you know, like... And that whole thing, that's weird to me.
I agree. So let's close by talking about fantasy.
Just a great natural transition straight from Christmas songs to fantasy football. But You, Mr. Fantasy Genius, have in fact made the final.
I've made it to the finals, and I'm playing against, my team is the best or the second best team in the league, and I'm playing against the other team who has right to that throne, our friend Nick, and I'm really excited when something like that happens. It's really cool when the best gets to meet the best. A clash of the titans, if you will. Holyfield and Tyson. The Rumble in the Jungle. Biggie versus Tupac. The Imperials versus the Rebellion. We're talking full on the Red Wedding right here is going to happen between the two of us. You don't get that reference.
I understand the existence of that reference.
Okay, perfect.
From Twitter.
It's really from, I heard about it on Twitter. These modern times. I'm really excited when the best gets to play the best. And if I have to give a modern NFL analogy, the team that I'm playing, they're the Seahawks. They're coming in hot. They are on fire, and I'm the Denver Broncos. This last week, in the second week of the first round of the fantasy playoffs, I had my worst week of any of the weeks of the season.
Actually, we're a little bit nervous that you might lose to Mrs. Fantasy Genius and have your season spoiled.
You know what? On this podcast last week, I scoffed at the idea of losing, and I was saved by a little man named Dan Bailey. So, an official Fabulous Peltoncast shout out to Dan Bailey for saving my fantasy season. And also, for reinvigorating my love for fantasy football.
Wow, it's back. That's
it. Oh, it is back. The threat of losing. I just dominated the first week of the fantasy playoffs so much. I was up by about 40 points. And then I seriously had a chance of losing if it were not for Dan Bailey's 24 that he put up last week. The highest total by a kicker of the entire season. Has to be up there with one of the highest kicker totals ever. It was an amazing performance by Dan Bailey. He trumped two different pretty impressive Justin Tucker weeks, including last night when he kicked 6 field goals.
Oh, that is true.
So, thank you, Dan Bailey. And nobody doesn't believe in the fantasy gods in a foxhole. Right?
Yes.
So, we haven't talked explicitly about the fantasy gods on this podcast, but I see no better time, right?
After you've spent 20 minutes talking about Christmas songs, it's all good.
So, the fantasy gods are... they're not real people. You have to believe in them. If you believe in them, they're there. If you don't believe in them, they're not. They can't hurt you. They can only help. Wait, they can hurt you. Never mind.
Yeah, they can definitely hurt you, especially if you describe yourself as a juggernaut.
The fantasy gods are there to make sure that you don't say anything too cocky, that you don't do anything too obnoxious throughout your year. The fantasy gods got somebody in the first round of the playoffs. On the other side of the bracket, playing against each other to play me, there was a person who made one of the biggest fantasy sins that you can make. In the playoffs, they had a player in who was out in Cecil Shorts. And the fantasy gods got them for that.
It's true.
They had no chance of winning. The gods don't allow that.
They had a chance of winning, and they might have won if they would have had someone in there.
The fantasy gods do not look pleasantly on that. And so you don't offend them. And throughout the day, while you're watching football, it's customary to talk to the fantasy gods.
For the record, I don't do that.
For the record, you have zero fantasy football victories. You have zero Coors Light Silver Bullet Boss Awards.
Touché.
So, me and my 4, and this year potentially 5, I'm in my 5th fantasy football finals. I am, for the record, undefeated in the fantasy football finals. I like to talk to the fantasy gods, thank them for what they have done. Russell Wilson throws a touchdown near the end of the game. I say, thank you, fantasy gods, for helping me out. Dan Bailey kicks a 50-yard field goal. I give a little thank you to the fantasy football gods. And they really like that. And they respond by helping me out through the rest of my game.
As opposed to cursing the fantasy gods when Le'Veon Bell gets his helmet knocked off at the goal line and instead of giving you a touchdown, he not only gets nothing, but is out for the game.
Sometimes the fantasy football gods work in mysterious ways. Sometimes the fantasy football gods like me more than anybody else. Don't like you at all.
Often.
But you don't talk ill of the fantasy football gods, and they keep you in check, and they keep the shit-talking that goes on in check also. So, they're an important group to talk to.
I guess I agree with all of that. I mean, I think to me it's mostly just, you know, don't say anything stupid and outlandish, because if you do, you're going to get brought back down to earth.
It's true. So I'm excited for the finals. I don't know if I'm going to win. This is the most competitive fantasy football finals that I've ever been a part of.
What do you think may make the difference?
What do I think might make the difference? So my opponent is playing Drew Brees this week. And Drew Brees going into Carolina is a big game. And if Carolina's defense can really get to Drew Brees and shut him down, I think that could be huge. I think that I have a couple Broncos on my team, Knowshon Moreno and Demaryius Thomas. Making sure that they're playing for something in week 17 is really important. And then also, if Russell Wilson, my quarterback, let's say that the Seahawks win this week against the Cardinals and he has a nice game, that could be huge. And then also finding potentially a replacement quarterback for him in week 17. One of the most important things around this time of year is just making sure that your players have something to play for.
Yeah, I mean, we're in a weird league because it goes all the way through week 17. Almost no other leagues do that.
It's true. I mean, I've only been in one other league and they also played through week 17, so it's kind of what I'm accustomed to.
I mean, it's a trade-off because the nice thing is you have 2 weeks in each round of the playoffs, so one random performance doesn't have as much positive or negative impact. I mean, if we were playing in a one-week league and last week was your playoff game, you would have been out.
It's true. I'm happy that that wasn't the case.
So
thank you again, Dan Bailey.
Life is full of trade-offs. Any pickups you're willing to share, or do you have to keep these secret for the...
No.
Okay. Well, then I guess we should close.
I'm being secretive about all of my claims. This is an important week.
It is. A lot on the line. We close as usual. Jermaine Kearse last week, 2 catches, 21 yards. He had 2 points. He has only combined for 4 points in the last 3 games since the bye week. But still, for the season now at 46 points to 6 for Vic Ballard, continues to dominate that and will continue to dominate. So... thanks for listening. If you made it all the way through this, you deserve probably sainthood. Anyway, thanks.
Thank you.